just see if this is working, and if it is, then I think we can get started. Seems to be all right.
So you have a Radio Shack recorder, and
it's this microphone is called a PZM microphone. It's a pressure zone microphone, and the sound is picked up from around the room right at that point. And it works very well. When I first started doing interviews, I always wired somebody with a mic, but this works just as well. And I've been using that now for several years.
Do you want me closer? Or?
No, that's fine. That's fine. I can pick you up just fine. Let me begin then by indicating that today is January 24th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Eugene Rakow at his home in Fort Myers, Florida. Dr. Rakow, I know you were born in Newark, New Jersey on October 4th, 1909. Could you tell me something about your father and your mother and your family background?
Mm-hmm. True, I was born in Newark, New Jersey. But before I was 1 year old, family moved out to rural Maplewood, west of Newark. My father bought a piece of land in the middle of a strawberry farm there, built a house there because he didn't think the city was a good place to bring up children. I have an older brother, excuse me. So, there we were in the middle of a strawberry patch, and why there? Well, there was an interurban electric streetcar. Excuse me. Can you shut off a minute?
Sure.
I think I'm ready. So, to continue, yeah, why out in Maplewood? Well, there was an interurban rapid transit line ran from Newark out to Springfield, New Jersey, which is famous for its part in the Revolutionary War. And that was about 200 yards from our place, and my father could ride the fast streetcar into Newark and work there. So there I was in Maplewood all during my childhood.
What did your father do in Newark?
Well, he was would be called a manufacturing chemist. That is, he began in a very modest way at a leather tannery, and he developed ways of making fancy bookbinding leather and how to color it and make it permanent and so on and so on. So that he educated himself and then took courses in business management and so on. Eventually, he rose to be president of the company. So a very hard-working man, and he set us, my brother and me, a good example. I have here something interesting. This book, which is family history, is bound in leather that my father made, and that was 100 years ago.
My goodness, it's beautiful.
Feel and perfect condition.
Oh, yes, yes.
You go in a library and try to find leather-bound books like that.
This says Berlin, 1861. Is that where he came from then?
He was born in this country, and his father before him, but his grandfather came from Lower Saxony. Well, Mark Brandenburg, if you know where Brandenburg is, up in northern Germany, northwestern Germany. As for the family, that's the family name. Family began in Switzerland. It seems that Charlemagne hired some unemployed Swiss knights to go north with him and fight the heathen Wendish in northern Germany. And when they succeeded in doing that and partly Christianizing the Wendish, the knights were rewarded by giving big plots of land. And so up there, just a little south and east of Brandenburg, between Brandenburg and Berlin, there are towns where the churches were built by the Rockau family, where they have the castles and the family manor houses and so on and so on. So a very interesting region to visit. So I went there twice, second time with my family, a kind of family research project, and it's amazing to see one's name on a church that was built in the 16th century and to find the history of all the deeds of the family from way back. I'm rambling too far, but my most famous ancestor of that time, who lived in a little town just south of Brandenburg, was Friedrich Eberhard von Rockau. And he's famous because he wrote that book, a primer for children, school children. But the schools at that time were just for rich kids. This man, Friedrich Eberhard, had the very far-sighted but revolutionary idea that farm children should have a chance at education. And so he was the first one to institute a public school. It wasn't public in the sense that the government organized it. No, he built a little schoolhouse which still stands there. And he wrote this primer, and he hired a teacher to teach all the surrounding children for free. And this was an astonishing thing at the time. His influence was felt all over northern Germany. So, very honored name. This copy, by the way, of the primer, Der Kinderfreund, is a reprint of the original. It was reprinted by the DDR, the Soviet government of East Germany. And this in itself is surprising because the churches and the castles around there that bore the family name were all carefully, what do you call it, not just de-emphasized, but the communists went around, went so far as to break open the family vaults, remove the bodies, put them out of the churchyard. They didn't want any trace of the nobility or the landowners to remain. And so, after some 50 years of that or more, they began to think about their roots, and they in fact found a few books. They wanted to prove that the communist lands and people weren't so bad after all, and that's one of the results. Sorry it took so long.
No, that's fine. It must have been pleasant in a way growing up in the country in Maplewood.
Oh, yes. Yes, we had real winters there and went sledding on the hill a short distance from our house. And, of course, ice skating in the winter. And we enjoyed the summers. Well, the nearest school was at, a region down near Irvington. It was about a mile and a half from where we lived. And, of course, we walked it, my brother and I, and later on, a cousin came to live near us. It was a long walk for a little fellow, but, I never thought of anything of it because everybody did it. In back of the school, there was a ravine with a nice brook back there, and so that was an informal nature study place. Crawfish grew under the flat rocks, and there were little fish in the brook. And I remember getting sent to the principal's office because I forgot all about time and stayed down there at lunchtime down at the brook, and it never occurred to me to go back to school, and suddenly it dawned me I should be back in class. So things like that happened. Very nice school, though. However, we went to what I would be called downtown Maplewood now. That was a village, actually. That's where the high school was there, and from there over there was a junior high and up to South Orange for high school. That's where I graduated from the high school.
Your older brother was 2 years older than you, is
yes.
that correct? At some point I read that you had a small attic laboratory. Was that his doing or yours?
Well, both. The house had an enormous attic in it, and there was an actual stairway going up there, none of this trapdoor stuff. So, of course, during bad weather, we could play up there in a big space like a barn. It had games, and we set up a movie screen, and there weren't any movies. We had a projection lantern. You could show slides and then project postcards by reflected light, and it had shows up there and charged the neighborhood kids 3 cents and so on. It was great fun. You know, you got older. My brother was interested in chemistry and I was interested in electricity. So we, of course, set up a little laboratory up there. That's where I made my own battery chargers and set up experiments with the first radio sets. You're not old enough, but
the old crystal set.
The first crystal set.
Mm-hmm.
Badgered my mother for one of the oatmeal boxes, another cardboard cylinder. Wound cotton-covered wire on it, taking taps every 10 turns, and then at the end, taps every turn for tens and units, and shellac on it to hold the thing on, and then, of course, you needed a crystal detector. The antenna was just a long wire strung from the house to a tree way out there, 100 or 200 feet. There was a radio station in Newark, WOR, still famous, so that we could get a good signal out in Maplewood, a crystal detector. I wonder if anyone has ever seen this stuff except to me. Maybe you know what it is, the Voning. No? Yet you use pieces of this every day. This is elementary silicon.
Oh, okay. And when it's, I should have guessed that's what it would be.
When it's crystallized and a single crystal grown slowly and carefully from the melt, that's sliced into thin wafers. And from that come all the computers and all the devices, every digital clock, every radio, every television set, devices that control the motor in your car and so on. All the marvels of the semiconductor age come from silicon. You could, of course, get a crystal of galena and break it up and use that. That's a natural lead sulfide. But that had to be bought from a supply house. Of course, that was beyond our reach. But this stuff, crude silicon, was an alloying agent for making ferrosilicon. Every AC motor, every AC generator, every transformer uses ferrosilicon laminations in the magnetic core. Maybe I'm lecturing too much about
this.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Why ferrosilicon? Why not soft iron core? Well, the alternating current, of course, induces, the field induces a current in the core as well as the copper windings. And the core, what's induced in the core is pure waste. It only overheats the thing. So by using thin sheets, laminations of ferrosilicon with an oxide scale on the laminations, they keep the current from going from one layer to the next, and the 10% of silicon and the iron would increase the electrical resistance enormously, so they could cut the losses way down. There wouldn't be any transformers out here without that particular result. Many companies experimented with ferrosilicon and silicon drain pipes for this and that because it's chemically resistant. And so if you could find somebody who had a 5-pound lump of this stuff, ask him to take a hammer and whack off a chunk, then you could make 100 crystal detectors from that chunk. So I got a flat sliver of silicon, strapped it down with a little short piece of copper onto a wooden board, and a phosphor bronze spring, a little piece of so-called brass spring wire sharpened to a point, and come down and touch around different places on the silicon surface till you found one that worked. That is, it rectified the radio frequency current that came in on the antenna and gave a direct current counterpart, which of course is modulated and needed only discard a telephone receiver, or if you were real rich, a pair of headphones. Music out of the air. Mm. No power input locally. Everything, power came from the broadcast station itself. We gloried in that. My brother and I, when we got enough money to buy a pair of headphones and took it apart, and it'd lie there on the bed listening to opera late at night, to music, to news, and in the dark. And my mother would come in and say, how do you shut this thing off? There is no shutting off, Mother. It just... And that was magic to her. So I went on with my interest in radio. And
how did your brother develop his interest in chemistry?
Well, the question, what should he do after high school? He'd like to go to college. All right. We were both admitted to Cornell on certification. Perhaps that's an unknown term to you. Many schools, high schools at that time, if they had proven the abilities of their graduates long enough, often enough, could be certified by some universities like Cornell, meaning that any student who was high enough in the percentile of the senior class and recommended by enough faculty people and the principal didn't have to take the college entrance exams and go right in. So, well, what to study there? Well, my brother Ted was urged by my father to study some chemistry because there's a possibility of succeeding my father as the working chemist in the plant. He himself, of course, went on up and up in management. So, all right, Ted studied chemistry. I was 2 years behind. It came time to graduate for me. I wanted to go to MIT and study electricity and radio stuff. But he said, look, I'm established up there at Cornell, and why don't you come up and study chemistry? We could have a lot of fun together, and maybe we could buy a little car then and drive back and forth, New Jersey, and so on. So he convinced me to try it. I guess I've been in chemistry ever since, but I've never abandoned electricity. You don't realize it as you sit there, but this room is wired for sound. That adjoining bathroom is wired for sound, the speakers there. The cable input from cable TV all over this little place in each room, so we can tap off what we want any place. I installed all of that, and I still glory in it.
You indicated that while you were in high school, first of all, I wanted to ask you if you had any chemistry classes in high school before you went to Cornell.
Oh, yes, indeed. We had a very good physics teacher in the Columbia High School in South Orange, and a capable chemistry teacher. The physics teacher headed the physical science department, as it was called, and he was a very bright and engaging fellow, and so my brother and I got along so well in chemistry that we were designated to set up the reagents for the next experiment. Actually, when we went on and did this at Cornell too, first Ted and then I, got a job as undergraduates, dissolving the potassium hydroxide and diluting the acids from the carboys and setting up, refilling all the bottles in the enormous freshman laboratory. So we load up the stuff in the basement prep room on this elaborate kind of tea cart, take it up in the elevator and go all the way around the laboratory filling the bottles. And of course, if the right stuff was not out on the right shelf at the right time, we caught hell. But we earned enough money that way to see us through undergraduate years.
You had mentioned two teachers. I'm assuming these were your chemistry and physics teachers. Parsons? Was Parsons the...
He was a physics teacher. Now, who was the chemistry teacher? You have so much information there. Do you have that, too?
Crehan?
He was a math teacher.
Oh, okay.
And he taught me to respect math, even to like it, almost to love it, because showed us so many things that could be done with math as a tool, as a language, if you just had the patience to learn about it. And so, English, Spanish. This is my yearbook from Columbia High School in science. Mary Allen. Parsons taught the physics courses. Mary Allen was a chemistry teacher, and she was a very pleasant, easygoing person. So we often turned to Parsons for enlightenment on the applications of mathematics to science. I have the pictures here, but I won't bother you with them.
That was 1927 that you graduated from Columbia?
27, my brother in 29, yeah. I went straight to Cornell.
How did you finance your way? You said you did these lab preps. Did your father help in financing?
Yes, my father contributed a certain amount, and he said, "Beyond, that's all I can do. From there on, you'll have to work part-time. And so, rather than take a job in a restaurant, cafeteria, or whatnot, we tried to get jobs in the chemistry department and got various odd jobs. And setting out the reagents was one of them. When I got to my senior year, I got a a fellowship there. Well, that went on into my graduate years. Hexa Research Foundation established some Hexa fellowships for promising students, especially graduate students at Cornell. And this gave a stipend equal to what the teaching assistants got. It wasn't just for free, though. You had to work on a research project and turn out a publishable piece at the end, and this was entirely in addition to working on a thesis project and turning in a thesis. So, in effect, it was a postdoctoral fellowship that was predoctoral. It ran concurrently with the doctoral work, and that's why it took me 4 years to go through graduate school at Cornell.
Before we look at your graduate work, let me come back to the undergraduate work. Who were some of the professors there, and what was the department like when you got to Cornell in 1927?
A very diverse and interesting department. You see, Cornell was founded by a businessman who made his money in telegraphy, installing the transatlantic telegraph cable. And so he said, and it stands on the seal of Cornell University, I would found an institution where any person may obtain instruction in any study. Now, that's a very big order. He wanted to found a place where all sorts of subjects were taught. And of course, this was founded in his hometown of Ithaca, New York, way up on the bluff overlooking Cayuga Lake, a beautiful location there. Cold as anything in the winter, but beautiful. Ezra Cornell. It's very important, the wording of that, although that's on the seal, because he said, where any person may obtain instruction. Now, at that time, there's no such thing as a coeducational college. There were some colleges for women founded further east, but Ezra Cornell and his first president, Andrew D. White, at Cornell had it very firmly in their minds that women would be admitted as soon as they could arrange separate living quarters and so on for them. So they built a nice brick college for women and admitted the first women, and it's been coeducational ever since.